Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference on the Webex presentation. All participants will be in listen-only mode for the duration of today's conference. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. May I now introduce your speaker for today, Jeff Wells. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. Thank you for making the time today to have a look at the equities side of the consolidated audit trail. The SROs are working together to bring more information about reporting for the broker-dealer community, and this is an opportunity, really, not just to look at the spec, but also give it some life and give you an idea about how it works. Also, we will have a question-and-answer session at the end of the presentation. So I'm Jeff Wells from Cboe Global Markets, and let's have a look at the agenda. As you can see, we're going to talk about the scope for equities and the fact that it's divided into a couple of phases. We're going to talk about the highlights and then some very specific elements of the CAT for reporting, especially those which are different from ones that people are previously used to. We will then phase into discussions about error corrections, the actual timelines for registering, and then something we call the regulatory conformance period. And a last section on the informational resources that you can use to get the definitive data, the tech specs, and the FAQs from the website, followed by the Q&A. So let's go on to the next slide. The key most important thing here to know, of course, is that equity securities for the consolidated audit trail cover all NMS stocks and OTC equity securities. And as you can see, the definition is here on the slide, and this is also in the FAQs, which is on the website. So you can see there are some very specific nuances there. If you now go to the next slide, you can see that we have split into two parts the reporting. There's the first part, which where the date is the 15th of November 2019, and then the second part for the 1st of September 2020. Essentially, we're going for events in the first half which are close to what people are used to with respect to OATS, and each of the individual elements here are noted in this matrix. And then the more complex varieties of reporting are in the later phase to give people more of an opportunity to get systems in order for that more complex reporting scenario, which may be quite novel, which is in fact quite novel. So they are the equities that are in scope and then the general timelines. If you go to the next slide, we can talk about the highlights within phase 2A. So it is all the data that people report into OATS. And really, a big reason for that is not just that it's something that people are used to reporting already, but also we want to retire the OATS system itself. So that's critical that comes in the earlier phase. It does include all the equity legs of complex orders, and this will these are the key drivers for phase 2A. And then you can see also all proprietary orders are in phase 2A. So that means all market making orders, orders originated by prop trading firms, and which is very important, all representative orders. So the idea really is that all of these will need to be reported and ultimately linked by the CAT system. So those are the phase 2A highlights. And now if you move on to the next slide, I would like to hand over to my colleague Shelley Bolin from FINRA to take you through the next part of the presentation.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. So the next portion of the presentation here is going to talk about the firm designated ID. So this is a brand new requirement of CAT and represents essentially the account number for which an order was placed. So this is one of the big steps forward with CAT that takes us beyond the scope significantly to be able to start having some account information even in an earlier phase than not wait all the way till the customer and account data. We're going to hit some of the highlights here today, but I would note that we have a series of FAQs. They're out on the CAT-MS plan website under the interpretive FAQs that go into detail about the FCID. And one of the things you'll see there that is not highlighted here but is very important, the operating committee has made the determination that for security, data security reasons, the actual account numbers cannot be used when reporting the transaction data to CAT. That a different number that would represent the FDID, the account number would be reported. So that's included in the FAQs on the website. But let's talk about the fundamentals here. So like I said, the FDID represents the account number of the customer account for which an order was placed. It is not representing a customer. It is representing the customer's account number. There are certain scenarios with institutional clients and funds where at the time an order is placed, the firm has an entity ID that is receiving the order from versus an actual account number. So in those instances, the FDID would represent the entity ID of the institutional client. For a proprietary account of a firm or any other firm-owned or controlled account, like an average price account or other type of account that might be used for representative orders, the FDID represents the account number of that specific account at the firm. So whatever the firm's proprietary account number is, that's what the FDID should represent. So in phasing this in 2A, since we will not have the customer and account information, the overall design of CAT is to use this FDID to go obtain the full complement of customer and account data from the customer and account information database that is not reported with or maintained with the transaction data. But in 2A, since we won't have the customer and account data, the question becomes, what is the purpose of this, or why are the SROs proceeding in 2A with the FDID? So what it will allow regulators to do in 2A is track the activity of a single account within a single broker-dealer. The same account trading across a broker-dealer will be able to be identified using this FDID. And then, as I mentioned, when the customer and account database is fully implemented, the FDID will be used to obtain the CAT customer ID from the customer and account database that then will be used to track the activity of a single customer across all CAT reporters. A couple other highlights here to note is that the FDID must be unique and persistent inside a single broker-dealer so that accounts can be tracked across time. So that's the purpose, to identify what an account is doing inside a single broker-dealer, and that is across days as well as within a single trading day. Another point to note is that if a firm is using multiple vendors to report to CAT, and the same activity for orders that are being placed for the same account, the same FDID representing that account must be reported by all of the different vendors so that, again, the same account can be tracked within a single broker-dealer regardless of which vendor submitted the activity to CAT. And we just note that the FDID, as in a scoping document and other materials that the SROs have published, As we are proposing this, all of this is caveated, obviously, by final approval by the SEC. But the FDIDNR phased approach would be optional beginning on November 15, 2019, and then would become required, mandatory, has to be populated by the end of the conformance period, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the presentation, which would be February 24, 2020. All right, so let's move on to the next slide. So the next big ticket item for phase 2A, that is a definite significant difference from existing OATS reporting, is that all representative orders, these are things like the street side of a riskless principle order, or if there's order aggregation scenarios where multiple customer orders are grouped and then worked as single larger orders through firm accounts. These are the kind of orders we're talking about when we say representative orders. And they must all be reported to CAT and marked as a representative order with limited exceptions. There is, we're going to defer to phase 2C, which we talked about in the spec and some other materials we published, like a guaranteed VWAP. Those very limited circumstances are being deferred to 2C, but as a general matter, outside of that, all representative orders have to be reported in 2A and marked as such. And the way that this will be done is there is a representative order flag that's in the spec that would be on all of the new order events that would indicate that it's a representative order, and then whether or not linkage is required, and if not, why. So you'll see here the values. Yes, this is a representative order, and the processor should look for the linkage. Then there's a supplemental value there, the YS, depending on how firms they want to come in and give supplementary events to link to the top order. Then we have this YF, which is meaning this is a representative order reportable in 2A, but the linkage is such that's not required to be reported until 2C. So that can be marked with this YF value. The YP value is related to this price guarantee scenario where in 2C, while the representative order will be required to be marked as such, there will never be linkage required because shares may not ever be given to the customer order. And then N, of course, is not a representative order. So all your other regular orders that are not representative should have this value of an N. All right, we can move on to the next slide. So related to these representative orders are in this deck an order fulfillment report. So any scenario where you are representing or originating a representative order, let's take riskless principle probably as the easiest and straightforward example. You get your customer order, you originate a principal order to send to the street, and then when that street side order and that there would be a new order and a route for that representative street side order, when that order is filled and the execution is given back to the client order on a riskless principle basis, that requires the reporting of an order fulfillment report to show that the customer order has been filled. And this, the order fulfillment event type, if you look at the spec, is a two-sided event that captures both the client-side details and the firm-side details. And the firm-side details would be the details about the specific representative order that was used to fill this client order. So as with representative orders themselves in 2A, not all the scenarios require the firm-side details to be populated. So the spec has accommodated that by allowing multiple values in this fulfillment link type field that they mirror closely as appropriate with the representative flags, whether, yes, this is a straight-up representative order scenario and linkage is required. Linkage is not required in 2A, but will be required in 2C, the YF. Then there's also a value to identify instances where there was a pre-existing principal order, such as a Manning fill, where the prop order was already out there and got, subsequently a customer order came in, the prop order gets filled, and now the client order has to be filled from that. So there wouldn't have been any way to link those at the order level, but at the fill level there is, so there's this YP value to indicate that. And then the last value is for foreign to indicate that this is the fulfillment of an order that had been routed to a foreign destination. So in the U.S., if everything's happening in the U.S., if you receive just a very simple one-to-one customer order on an agency basis, you report a new order, you report a route, the route's going to the exchange, it's filled, you're done, there would not be an order fulfillment. However, if you have routed the order to a venue that is not a CAT reporter, CAT must have a way to identify the fill, and this would be foreign exchanges, since in CAT now all U.S. broker-dealers and exchanges are subject to CAT reporting, but there are orders, obviously, that go to foreign markets. So in that instance, because we don't have the fill information from the foreign market, we have to get it through an order fulfillment, and that's what this foreign value indicates. Next slide, please. So we've talked about in 2A, you've got all the rep orders, you've got the fulfillment. Now, I wanted to take a few minutes and focus on when linkages will be required in 2A. So we have a fairly narrow scope here of what, and this is as a result of many conversations with industry groups and industry members about what is achievable in a 2A time frame. And as you can, I won't read it word for word, but essentially if you've got a single, the important points are here, you have a single customer order and are then generating these representative orders and any of the fills that have, and there's already an existing direct electronic link between those two in the firm systems because there are many scenarios where those links don't exist, and then any resulting executions are immediately and automatically applied back to that single customer order. In those limited instances, linkage is required in 2A. And we would note another important point here is that these linkages are required at the order level regardless of whether the trade or the order gets executed or not. So an unexecuted order would have a link between the representative order and the single customer order it's representing. And if nothing else ever happened to it, that's all that would be there. If a fill occurs or that representative order is executed, then when the order fulfillment is reported for the client side order, then the link has to be there between the two. Let's go on to the next slide and talk about the different linkage keys, and these are all in the spec. I would also point out that there is an appendix in the back of the industry member spec that lays out in great detail each of the different kinds of scenarios and when linkage is required and when it is not in each of the different phases. So I strongly encourage firms to look at that appendix. Unfortunately, I don't know the appendix number off the top of my head. And then there's the reporting scenarios document that we talked about, I believe, last week, and there are scenarios inside that document that illustrate how these linkages work in the different scenarios and represent or illustrate what these linkage keys are that we're talking about on this particular slide. So on the order level, there's a representative indicator that indicates that's those YF values. And if it's a straight-up Y, meaning there's linkage required in 2A, then there's an aggregated orders field in which the actual order ID from the client order is supplied that provides the linkage between the two. And then at the order fulfillment level, it's a two-sided report, as we talked about, and on the firm side details it's the order ID of the firm order that was used to fill that client, and that's where the linkage occurs. And then there's a fulfillment link type indicator that tells, whether, like we talked about, that Manning fill scenario or procedure phase, et cetera. All right, so let's move on to the next slide. And at this point, we're going to move on to some other components of the 2A scope. And I'm going to turn it over to Paul McKinney from FINRA to talk about the equity quote reporting.
Great. Thanks, Shelley. Good afternoon, everybody. This slide focuses on the equity quote reporting. And the quote reporting has also been divided somewhat up between Phase 2A and Phase 2C. In Phase 2A, what's going to be required to be reported are the quotes in NMS stocks that are sent to an exchange or to the ADF, anybody sending quotes there. Also quotes in OTC equity securities that are received by an industry member that's operating an inter-dealer quotation system, or IDQS. Additionally, quotes in OTC equity securities that meet the definition of a bid or offer under the plan language that's sent by a broker-dealer to a quotation venue not operated by a CAT reporter. Those are all reported in Phase 2A. And then in 2C, industry member CAT reporters have to report quotes in those OTC equity securities that are sent to an interdealer quotation system that's operated by an industry member CAT reporter. So if you're sending those orders to an IDQS, you would not have to report those until Phase 2C. However, if you're operating an IDQS and you're receiving those quotes, those you would need to report in Phase 2A. Okay, next slide, please. So the next item we wanted to talk about and focus on are order handling instructions on order routes. This is a bit of a new concept in the plan. It's very different from equity reporting in OATS. The plan does require that all material terms and conditions of a routed order be reported. So this would include special, routing instructions or instructions that are provided to a receiving venue. So these conditions would have to be reported in the handling instructions field in on the order route events, as stated in the technical specifications. You would not be reporting, if you're sending an order to an exchange, you would not be reporting the exchange-specific values. Those would not be in the spec. However, you want to take a look at the spec and identify those codes that most closely resemble or reflect the instruction that you're using to send the order to the exchange. Now, there could be instances where an industry member would receive special handling instructions and then just simply pass those special handling instructions on to the venue to which they're routing the order. If that's the case, then you would have a choice. You can, there is a special handling or a handling instruction code called RAR, which stands for Routed as Received, which basically says, any handling instructions that are on my new order event or my order accepted event also apply to the route event. Or, of course, you could also choose to lay out those handling instructions on the route event as well. Next slide, please. So the next item that we wanted to talk about are industry member IDs. This is something that we did talk about in the last presentation last week, but we feel that it is an important concept, and we really want to make sure that firms understand this. Basically, the IMID is an SRO assigned identifier that's used to report to CAT or to identify sending and receiving firms. So now when you hear the term IMID, that is essentially the CAT language for an SRO assigned identifier. So that could be an MPID, it could be a trading mnemonic, items like that. What it does not include are CRD numbers. So CRD numbers may not be used to submit data to the CAT or to identify routing and receiving broker dealers in the CAT reports. So we have to use an SRO assigned identifier. And then we have laid out a lot of information in the CAT Alert 2018-003, which was published in October. If we could move to the next slide, I can give you the highlights of that. Basically, what this says is that, we want to be sure that we have the IMIDs. They're very important in the DAISY chain and creating the linkages. So when you're routing an order to an exchange, the sender IMID field in the route event has to be, you have to use the identifier or populate that with the identifier that you use to enter the order into the exchange. This is very consistent with the OATS guidance that we have out there today or that's used today. It's the equivalent of the exchange participant ID on the OATS route report. And then when you're routing an order to another industry member, the same IMID has to be used by both the sender on the route event as well as the receiver on the order accepted event. Those would need to be consistent so that we can provide or create a proper linkage between the two routing firms. Next slide, please. So another new concept is the idea of a default CAT reporting MPID. So the plan processor is going to publish each day a list of all the SRO assigned identifiers, and this will include a default CAT reporting IMID. And this default IMID is going to be selected by each CAT reporter during their registration process. So when they sign up, they'll be providing all their a particular IMID that they've received from the SROs that they have identified as their default CAT reporting IMID. So if there's an instance where parties that are routing to each other do not have a predetermined agreement as to which IMID should be used when reporting either the receipt or the route, then they should be using the published default CAT reporting IMID, which again would be able to be found on that identifier, the SRO assigned identifier list that's going to be posted. The default IMID can either be an equity or options assigned identifier, and it can be used on either equity and options events, so it's not necessarily product specific. And then if there are any types of conflicts with SRO assigned IMIDs, there could be instances where a particular IMID, say ABCD, might be assigned by different SROs for different entities, thus creating a conflict. Then firms can choose to resolve that conflict in one of two ways. They can either change the IMID to use a different IMID from the list that does not conflict with the other identifiers that are assigned by other SROs, or they can populate the IMID field with that same identifier and then add the name of the issuing SRO. So that would help break the conflict between the two MPIDs. So let's just say, if FINRA and SIBO both assigned an identifier of ABCD, and the firm is using that identifier to route an order, then they could resolve that conflict by populating ABCD-SIBO to identify which IMID they're actually using. So, again, all this information is laid out in more detail in that CAT alert 2018-003 that's published on the technical specifications page of the CATNMSplan.com. So I certainly encourage everyone to take a look at that. Next slide, please. Okay, with that, I'm going to hand it over to Todd Golub from Thesis CAT, who's going to talk to you a little bit about error corrections.
Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everybody. Understanding the additional challenges CAT reporting brings to the industry, namely requiring all corrections to be submitted by 8 a.m. on T+3, including the fixing of linkage errors, CAT is planning to provide several efficiencies and tools to assist industry members with this process. Some of those items are listed on the current slide. CAT will allow for submission, feedback, and corrections to be made in either CSV or JSON format. In addition, reporters may submit one metadata file from multiple order files or correction files so long as the files are the same calendar date. Similarly, corrections from multiple original files may be submitted in a single correction file for a given calendar day, referencing the original file number along with the index of the record requiring remediation. Lastly, the CAT reporter portal GUI and API will be made available to industry members for status of submissions and errors, as well as the ability to submit some reports via the GUI itself. Next slide, please. Moving on to CAT registration and timelines. ThesisCAT, together with the SROs, are finalizing the registration process, including the initial identification of CAT reporters by way of SRO membership and the creation of the requisite forms. Starting in December, CAT reporters will begin submitting basic information to CAT, including business name and address, primary contact and registered principal, preferred connectivity, and some more CAT-specific information, for example, your primary contact, and when you, as an industry member, are expecting to be reporting based on the proposed phased approach. I wanted to highlight this point. When registering for CAT, industry members will self-declare when they believe they are to begin reporting based on the proposed phases. In addition, as earlier mentioned, at this time, industry members will be permitted or will have the opportunity to identify their default IMID. Starting in March, primary contacts will begin identifying access administrators and individual users at an organization. Please note the connectivity information deadline in May. As previously mentioned, ThesisCAT will provide a web-based GUI, the reporter portal, to users in order to monitor their submissions. The registration and setup process for reporter portal will begin in June. Lastly, while connectivity will take place throughout the process, we have a line item here to complete it through the end of July into August, with testing available beginning August 15th. And with that, I will hand it back to Shelley Bolin.
Great. Thank you, Todd. So wanted to just close out here or to talk a little bit more in depth about the proposed regulatory conformance period. So understanding from the timelines that the industry member test environment will become available in August of 2019 and an effort to allow the longest amount of time possible to work through system issues and other, obviously, any type of implementation of this size, there will be issues that arise as it gets initially implemented. And with the goal of beginning industry member reporting in 2019, the SROs have proposed this concept of a regulatory conformance period that would run from November 15, 2019 through February 24, 2020, essentially allowing an additional 3 months to continue to work through issues that are anticipated, again, like I said, with any new implementation of this size. So what this conformance period means to people or to CAT reporters is that you would not be subject to regulatory action for failing to meet the maximum allowable error rates or for failing to correct those reporting errors that Todd was just talking about in that T+3 time frame if certain things were done by the CAT reporter. And so turns to, well, what will you be required to do during this conformance period? So the first and most important thing is that on November 15, 2019, all CAT reportable activity under 2A must be reported. So there's no gradually trickle in parts of your reporting. Everything has to be reported starting on November 15, 2019, and it has to be reported each day by that 8 a.m. Deadline, the next trading day. So it has to come in timely. Then the next prong is that when there are issues that come up and firms have a large number of rejections or unlinks or whatever it is, that the firm make a reasonable effort to identify and correct what the root cause of the problem is. So correct system, coding errors, that type of thing that needs to be promptly addressed so that the rejections and unlinks can cease. And you can get back to, clean reporting. So you can't sit there and watch massive rejections occur for 2 months and not do anything about it. That is not what this is. It needs to be working to correct the root cause. And then a very important prong of this is that by November 15th, that there is, each firm, CAT Reporter, has an adequate CAT reporting supervisory system in place. So they need to be monitoring the reporting on a daily basis. They need to have all the, you know, requisite components of an adequate supervisory system, all of it documented, et cetera. So that has to be there November 15th as well. So to the extent that a CAT reporter would fail to report any portion of their activity, they fail to identify and correct coding errors promptly, like I said, you let a massive issue continue for an extended period of time, or you fail to have a supervisory system in place, you could still be subject to some sort of regulatory action during this conformance period. And then February 24th, at that point forward, everybody would be expected to be correcting your errors within the T+3 timeframe, and everything would be as it will be in a steady state. All right, so move on to the next slide. And I'm going to turn it back over to Todd, who will quickly just refresh everybody on the informational resources that are available.
Thank you, Shelley. Let me take you through some resources we have available for you, first on catnmsplan.com. So, as you see on the page here, we have the technical specifications page of CatNMS Plan. So in the top banner, you see the various menus. By clicking on technical specifications, it will bring you to this page where you have the industry member technical specifications, the scenarios that correspond or go with those specifications, the three CAT alerts that were discussed earlier today, as well as some field level mapping and OTFAQ to CAT mapping. Next slide, please. Also in the top banner, you'll see where we have the FAQs. There are currently three sets made available. There's general FAQ, interpretive, and OATS FAQ to CAT mapping. As we continue to update our FAQs, they will be updated to this site into the correct section. And how would you learn about all these things that are taking place? By going to the website at the bottom, you will see in the lower banner, the subscribe. Clicking on that will bring you to a section where you can sign up for email subscriptions from CAT NMS Plan Alerts. Thank you. And then while I'm at least talking about the alerts, allow me just to say that as we talk about the various webinars like we're having today and the announcements of when FAQs come out or when specifications are updated, when the presentation such as today will be posted to the CatNMS Plan website, all of that information will be announced by way of this CatNMS Plan Alerts functionality. So we very much encourage industry members interested in maintaining or staying abreast of updates on CatNMS Plan, this would be the best way to do it. Thank you. And then the next slide, please. And then lastly, we have the help desk available via email and phone. You can see the various topics that are being made available or can be covered by contacting the help desk. Please understand that as we are working with the SROs on a number of items, for most particularly interpretive items, that there are certain questions that may take a little bit longer than others to get back to you as we will need to go back to the SROs for interpretive items. But as far as technical items, technical items, system security, media relations, the dates, certainly that you can contact our help desk for that. And with that, I will hand it back to Jeff Wells. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd. That was Todd from CSIS CAT. So we're now in the question phase, and there may be some good questions we can't answer on the fly, but we will do our best to do that. I can see that the first question that came up is, tomorrow is the go live for SROs. How is their reporting readiness? Well, all the SROs will be reporting for the trade date, November the 15th, and that will be definitely done. Everybody has been preparing for quite some time, including reporting into a pre-production mode of the production environment in November. So that one is taken care of. I wonder if Second question there is possibly one that Shelley could take. Where did it go? Oh, yes. Can there be more than one representative order for one client order? And if that will, and if that will be accepted in phase 2A, is that something, Shelley, you could handle?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So, yes, the answer is yes. A single customer order can be linked to multiple representative orders, and there's no issue with that. And if the multiple representative orders are referring back to the same customer order in the aggregated order field, that's fine. And we have scenarios in the spec that illustrate that. So, yes, absolutely, you can do multiple rep orders for a single client order. About whether you can voluntarily report linkages from 2C and 2A. Todd, would you want to take that one? If the spec will accommodate that.
Thank you, Shelley. Yes, absolutely. For the representative linkages, you will have industry members, reporters will have the ability to do multiple linkages, not just the one-to-one. So you can go above and beyond. You can do your 2C reporting from that perspective. The spec does allow for that.
We have a question here about, with respect to the conformance period, if there were a scenario where there was an error that resulted in errors that could not be corrected, what would have to happen there? And I think during this conformance period that there's going to be a lot of different scenarios, and that we're going to, we don't have a bright line list of exactly how each and every scenario would be handled at this time, the guiding principle. So I think if they couldn't be corrected, we would have to understand what the circumstances were that surrounded that, and deal with it on a case-by-case basis. So there's a question here on how to go about registering as an industry member reporter. Todd, is that one that you would be able to take?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, we are working on coming up with that mechanism with the SROs right now. It will not be through FINRA websites. It'll be either through CAT-NMS plan directly on that website, or we will be sending out emails to the individual SROs. But we do want to make sure that we come up with the best means of going out, reaching out to the various industry members to ensure that we have a valid connection.
We have a number of questions here on FDID and when an entity ID can be used. And I would just say that we will, this is obviously an area that has a lot of different circumstances, scenarios, and how to address each one. We will be working on providing more specific guidance on exact instances when an entity ID can be used. But as a general matter, the entity ID concept is there for when you have a legal entity fund type of a scenario where, a large fund A comes in with an order for the day and will not have any accounts until later, the sub-accounts until later. And at the time the order is placed at the entity level, what the firm has is an entity ID. So that is what is intended to be used for. So there's different, we're being asked here, we have several questions about BD activity, if a customer account is not known. I'd rather just let you know that we will be providing more granular guidance on this moving forward. But what I just described is really what the entity ID is intended to be used for. And there's one here on broker-dealer principal activity. that is the actual account number of whatever prop account or the FDID that represents that account number. So we would be expecting an FDID representing this specific account at the broker-dealer. There's one here, maybe Todd, this one to you, how long will Fusus Cat hold a GTC order in their system?
Sure, Shelley. Cat has an obligation to hold all data, I believe, for up to 6 years. So unless that something is canceled out, that is my understanding.
But the people, it's Jeff here, the people need to resubmit each day. I think that might be the intent of the question, if they have a GTC.
No, there's no daily restatement of GTCs from the industry members.
Thanks.
There's a question here about session ID and whether that is understanding that it's not mandatory or will not be allowed between when routing between two industry members, but what about to an exchange? And it would be in that case, and we will be publishing similar to what is in existing in OATS today, the specific protocol by protocol mapping for each exchange and what will be used in the linkage there. So look for that. It should be coming shortly. There's a question here. When is OATS targeted for decommissioning? So obviously the first benchmark, the first target that has to be met is the full implementation of 2A with full OATS scope. And then it would be, I would refer people to FINRA's previous OATS retirement filing that we had submitted, that we had subsequently withdrawn, but we'll be refiling, in which we talked about one of the very important criteria will be the compliance rates that are achieved in CAT. We must have high compliance rates to be able to move from OATS to CAT. And we had, in that previous filing that we had submitted, said that we would be looking to retire OATS no earlier than 180 days after CAT goes live to make sure that the compliance rates are there and that FINRA is able to ensure that all the data we need for our surveillance patterns currently running off of OATS are, in fact, being captured and reported correctly in CAT so that we can then move over to CAT. But again, like I said, I would refer people to our previous retirement filing for, you know, what we had, what we are looking towards in that retirement plan. There's a question here. When two parties do not have a predetermined agreement as to which IMID should be used, the published default CAT ID may be used. Given that, why would IM not, and then the question stops. I'm not quite sure what the rest of the question was.
Shelley, this is Paul. It may be asking why they would not use the default ID, and there could be instances where there are well-established connections between broker-dealers that the IMID that they are using is clearly known, so that they would just continue to go ahead and use those IMIDs.
Then there's the next one here is about when will different stages of CAT processing be done. Todd, could I kick that one over to you?
Sure. So there are various stages as described in the specification, and each stage occurs in order. But upon receipt, there's an initial acknowledgement, and that happens immediately. And then each of the stages subsequent to that, depending upon if we have all the information in or not. So certainly the acknowledgement can happen immediately. However, we cannot process the event files without the metadata files. So there's certain dependencies that are required in order to go through the different processes. However, everything is supposed to be or is required to be submitted by 8 a.m., so all the processes that have not kicked off yet will start at 8 a.m. and then will complete as soon as possible.
Great. Thank you. So the next question here is, why are order handling instructions required from broker-dealers on order routes? Isn't the data better available from the exchanges? So the simple answer is Rule 613 requires that the material terms and conditions of a routed order be provided on the route. So that is why the rule requires that. The next question, Todd, sorry, this one might be back to you again. When will the full list of error codes be published?
It's currently in process, but I believe that we have a March 31st date out there right now.
Then there's a question, is there any expectation for mismatches to be resolved via the repair resubmission process? So if I'm understanding the question correctly, the answer is yes. Unlike OATS, unlinked events must be repaired and resubmitted so that a linkage can occur. That is a material change from existing OATS requirements. And then there's a question about whether CAT will publish a monthly report card similar to the OATS report cards, and the answer to that is yes. So the question, we have another question here, are stock legs for exchange for related positions tied to futures trades reportable to CAT? So the answer is yes. Any of these equity legs are reportable just as they are in OATS. So again, we have to replicate the OATS scope. So there are different codes available in OATS to indicate whether it's like tied to, it's an option related, it's an exchange for physicals, it's whatever it is. The short answer is yes. Those equity legs are reportable in 2A. Again, to replicate OATS scope so we can retire OATS. So we have, is the order fulfillment consistent with interpretive FAQ 7? We'll have to take a look at that and get back on that one. There's a registration question here about whether a registered principal has to be named. I believe the answer is yes, but Todd or Paul, I'll defer that one over to you.
So from our perspective, we were expecting that to be as part of the registration process. Paul, if you disagree, feel free to do so.
No, I agree with that. Yeah, we would expect a registered principal to sign off on the registration form.
So there's a question here. For order type, there's three, cabinet, limit, and market. What is the definition for cabinet? I don't know if any step or that is related to auctions.
Yeah, it's a specific kind of transaction that occurs to basically clear out options contracts, which are almost worthless, but not quite. So cabinet is a term that's used in the options market.
There's a question here whether the primary administrator or delegated administrators need to be registered principals.
So those individual roles, I don't believe are – the access administrator is not expected to be or is not required, I believe, to be a registered principal. However, the primary contact, whereas there needs to be a registered principal, whether or not the primary contact is that registered person, I don't think is required at this time, but I'll leave that open for, I guess, Paul, if someone else.
No, I agree with that. If you're referring to the primary administrator of the web access and access to the tools of the CAT, I don't believe that that would be required to be a registered principal.
So there's a question here, is there a definition for what a representative order is? And I think in the different, the plan itself and then in the spec and the FAQs, this is, you know, any order that's originated in a firm owned or controlled account for the purpose of working a customer order, but if the ask here is like an FAQ specifically worded as such, what is the definition of that? We can take that back and look to formulate a specific FAQ, but it's in all of the different scenarios and guidance, et cetera.
Yeah, if the FAQ is not there already, we can make sure that's up on the website. I saw the next one is a question that is, I know this is an equity-based seminar, but it appears prop trading firms have to report quotes sent. I thought I heard in the options space that exchanges will report quote options related. Is that true? So what's meant here is that there is an exemption for options quoting, and the specifics of that we will go over in the options deep dive seminars. We've actually got some we've actually got in-person meetings designed on November 29th, December 4th, January 29th, and January 31st, and those are first in New York, then Chicago at SIBO, New York again, and then Chicago. So we can talk about those kind of things for the options space at those events. The general idea behind it was that options market makers, of course, produce an enormous amount of data, and the exchanges can, of course, do receive all of that data. So with the quote sent time, that can be reported on their behalf. Hope that makes sense. The question 23 is about registering as an industry member. Is that already covered?
Yes, Jeff. I believe that I answered that. That information will be coming, and that it, as far as the portal, it will not necessarily be through a FINRA portal, but it will be through CAT.
Through CAT's own portal, right? Then there's another FDID question. Is that something that we're able to answer at the moment? Number 24. Shelley, if it hasn't been covered already?
Yeah, no, I think, so this is, I think it's sort of been covered for firm accounts. Is there a separate and distinct FDID for each type of a firm account? So it's for each account. So the example here is an error account versus a facilitation account. So they would have, I assume, two different account numbers at the firm, so they would need two different FDIDs.
Oh, I see. Yep. So if there's a different account number, it must have a different FDID. There's a question number 25 about the SRO data in production. Is it available to the broker dealers so that they can link to their routed orders to the exchanges? No. Not quite sure what the intent of the linkage would be done, is going to be done by the consolidated audit trail itself and then available to the regulators. So I think that's the answer to that one. There's a question about rebilling to an error account and how CAT would support that using the FDID scenario. Is that something that we have enough detail on to answer?
Yeah, I think we will be looking, as we have, like in an OATS context, to publish specific guidance on error corrections and error account usage, and we would look to address any FDID issues when we formulate that guidance.
And question 27 really is for Todd, asking about more information with regard to the reporter portal. So over to you, Todd.
Thank you. There certainly will be more information coming out in the coming months. I believe there'll be a couple of sessions, at least with the SROs and some industry members, to talk about some of the requirements that would be needed for the reporter portal over time. So there will certainly be more information over the next few months. Again, I would encourage everyone to sign up on the CADNMS plan alerts, and you'll get that information right away.
All right, I can see there's a few more questions here. So do CAT service providers need to register on behalf of IMIDs or IMIDs?
Hey, yes, I'll take that. They certainly do. Whereas we plan to go out to the industry, or that we hope to go out to the industry with the registration, CAT submitters, the authorized reporter submitters, will need to come into CAT and register, and we will provide that information via the website shortly.
And then there's a follow-up question related to that, which is question 29. Why would IMs not just be told to report using the default CAT reporting ID in all cases that do not involve exchanges?
I think Paul had covered this. Where I think the idea was we were not looking to change anyone's business practices. So if there are already relationships in place where it's understood what IMIDs are being passed between them, that nothing should change. However, where it is not known and where counterparties don't want to or cannot reach out to one another to collect that information, the default is available.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. That's correct. And I just want to follow up on the question where CAT service providers need to register on behalf of IMIDs. Just to clarify, the CAT service providers will have to register for themselves, but it's also all CAT reporters, so each industry member that will have CAT data submitted either on their own or having somebody else submit for them, each broker-dealer will need to register with CAT in addition to the service providers.
Yeah, good point, Paul. There's a day one question here that you might know the answer to, Todd, which is question number 30. On day one, any special requirements for open GT orders which were entered into the system before go live?
I assume that means GTC orders.
Yeah,
and
most likely.
From our perspective, I don't believe so, but Shelley or Paul or actually anybody else, if there's an obligation on behalf of from you, if there's any kind of restatement that's necessary.
So I'm interpreting this as an order that was originated or received prior to the effective date, like the November 15, 2019 effective date, and we are... tomorrow, actually, we'll be publishing the OATS to CAT mapping, FAQ mapping. If everyone recalls, we're doing our CAT-specific FAQs, and there will be an FAQ about the reportability of events on orders that were received prior to November 15th. So they're not, if it's received prior to the November 15th date, it's not required to be reported like we've done historically with other OATS implementations. But I don't believe there would be any system impact. Like Todd, I think this might be what you were saying. If you were to submit a route on something that the parent's not there, it won't reject. The system would take it, but it's not required to be reported if the order was received prior to the effective date.
Yeah, thanks, Shelley. And there's a couple more, but I feel that they're going to keep coming in, and maybe we should take, unless you can take them really quickly, maybe we should take them into the FAQ process itself. Although I did have one, I thought, really good one I'd like to answer, which said, for the in-person meetings, wouldn't it be better to meet somewhere like Miami instead of Chicago in the middle of winter? That was a very good idea, but unfortunately, we haven't been able to get facilities in Miami. Probably in the hurricane season we could get those. Are there any other questions you could take quickly, Todd or Shelley?
There's one in our next requirement, but I think we already covered that. And then the list of convertible bonds being included in the daily reportable security list. If it's the list will have all of the if it's in an NMS.
Yes, if it qualifies, it will have to be in the list.
Yes. Yeah, so I think that looks like the questions have dissipated, but this will not be the only opportunity, obviously, for Q&A, and as the Miami question was alluding to, we're doing some in-person options, but we will, as we move forward, obviously host the appropriate events and make sure that there is mechanisms for everyone to interact with the SRO staff and get the answers to their questions.
That's right, and this presentation will be put onto the website and the recording and the PowerPoint. So, do register to keep up to date with information, and we'll respond as soon as we can to any fresh FAQs. They do go through a process of vetting and then and approval, and then they get new ones. Then will be published on the website. So I think that's about it. Thank you very much, everybody, and we'll give you back the rest of the evening.
And that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now all disconnect. Speakers, please stay for the final line count.